morning, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearing. Just before we start, we have a table here. Could you just quickly, I think about three sentences, tell us what it is, please, so that we can have it on the record?
Yes, sir. It's scheduled for the memorandum that we'll hopefully file by tomorrow lunchtime, but essentially the main points are for the table because that's available, and it is it's the output of a random selection of controlled activity resource consent applications in the rural lifestyle and rural residential zone granted between 2014 and 2016, and the output of the data shows the largest size of the dwelling, the largest size of any one building that was constructed within a building platform in the rural lifestyle and rural residential zone. Obviously the rural residential zone doesn't have building platforms. It shows the smallest, and obviously we've got the median and the average size as well. And we also included whether or not there was a landscape plan provided with the application and consent that is part of the resource consent.
How did you do the random selection?
The data was derived from a an internal report that was run with the qualifiers of controlled activity resource consent in those three zones. From there, so we had quite a high output of resource consent applications. From there, in Microsoft Excel, you can pull random, and the function where you can pull random and select a random number of applications.
Right, so you use that random number generally.
That's right. That's right.
I'm just thinking that it is generally random.
So. Yes, it is. Yes. So as you can see, I think everyone's aware of the odd building that's over 500 metres squared, but we didn't come across them in this analysis.
Have you got any idea what the total number was?
Yes, and I can...
If you could put that in the report, it would be useful just so we know that what...
The original data set was?
Yes, thanks.
Any questions? In terms of the buildings and that are associated with the number, do the buildings include water tanks that are used? Do they come within that?
No, probably not. It would be the footprints. It would be the footprints. My understanding is that there are about three staff involved helping collect this data, but it was the floor area of the building is ground floor level, so it's the footprints of the ground floor of the building.
So that means that it would cover accessory buildings like garages,
that's right,
implement sheds.
That's right. So yeah, anything with a roof on it, that's the building, defines the building, but excluding the eaves. So essentially, the footprint of the building.
So it's possible that some of these smaller buildings could be accessory buildings within the same footprint as some of the bigger ones if they were done by different consents.
That's right, the resource consent. That's right, there may well have been a previous resource consent which was to do with previous buildings within that building platform, and the consent which is the consent file referenced here could be a garage or an extension to that, but it's the sum from those consents to some of the buildings on the platform.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Mr. Cooper. There's a review here, so.
Yes, thank you, sir. I guess you were actually aware of the holes and what this page would put out holes.
Yes.
So I wasn't continued to present the summary to you unless you wanted.
No, that's fine. We can go straight to questions.
I did want to make one change for conservative. You'll be sitting there thinking this guy when I was talking about it, but you referred to the wrong policy in paragraph 19 on page 6 of my evidence. Most people tell them I'm too loud. So. I've referred there in the brackets here on the third line, see objective 33.2.1 and policy 33.2.11.9, which you probably work out doesn't exist. So that's a typo, so it probably should read 33.2.1.9 and it should also have 33.2.2.1 there. So I apologise for that, sir, but I'm sure you've probably picked that up.
Turning to paragraph 12 in your evidence, in the second sentence there, when you talk about might be diversity, not the quantity of the living organisms and the ecological complexities that's to be maintained, I understood or understand that there was a range of factors set out in policy 3219 which contributed to the reasons for addressing indigenous vegetation clearance, and that it wasn't just what the diversity was.
Are you talking in the context of the district plans provisions?
Yes.
That could be correct. What I'm saying in this paragraph, I'm keeping in terms of my view on if you step back a few paragraphs, what I've basically said is the Act has two very important sections around indigenous biodiversity, section 6 of your matters of national importance, and it's quite a strong threshold protection, but there's that more general requirement to maintain indigenous vegetation. All I'm saying in paragraph 12, not from a district plan point of view, and I accept the district plan could probably go further than what the Act says, I'm just saying there that what that probably means in my view, maintenance doesn't necessarily mean that you have to maintain even a little bit of indigenous vegetation. When you go back to the definition of biodiversity, it's about maintaining that diversity. I haven't considered that in the context of what the district plan has said. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but obviously.
In terms of the paragraph 17, talking about land, threatened land environments, what's your understanding of the purpose of lens? And from what I've heard so far, my understanding is that it's really just the identification of areas where vegetation is removed, and basically that there's limited examples, for instance, of what's actually left.
The threatened land environments, yes, that's my understanding too, but the way they come about, I think, is a factor of environmental things that, that identified areas that will have similar characteristics and therefore potentially similar vegetation in those areas. I think there's a range of environments that will be involved in the one in Gillam here. Is where there is probably less in decisions to buy the rest of cover remaining.
In paragraph 20, you're 20 and 21, I think you refer to the protectionist approach at odds with the strategic direction. How does the protectionist policy stack up against, I've got objectives 3.2.4.3, sorry, do you have a copy of the, you probably need a copy of the district proposed district plan.
I do have a photocopy of that. So it was objective
2.4.3 and the associated policy. Trying to understand, you've identified that the objective in your evidence 3.2.5.5, if you reference that, as I'm assuming to give direction within the rural zone for the use of agricultural land.
Yes.
What I, in terms of when we're looking at chapter 33, I'm trying to see whether there are other policies within the, or objectives within the strategic chapter that direct, give more direction to the type of protectionist policies that you've referred to.
Yes, well, we're that, I look at that policy and I think what I'm referring to in my paper, paragraph 20 is the policies framework and the indigenous vegetation. So I see that this one you'll refer to as more of an overview approach. But I think there's a bit of a disconnect when you get down into the specific section with those policies that I noted earlier when you talk about avoid effects on habitat, avoid effects on indigenous vegetation. And some of the context there is not actually focusing on significant vegetation per se. It seems to actually link in general and indigenous biodiversity as a whole rather than focusing on the six matters which we would expect a protectionist approach.
Sorry, could you expand on that a bit more? What I'm trying to get at is that it seems to me that the objectives and policies that 3.2.4.3 seem to be almost, that's directing a protectionist type approach, whereas objective 3.2.5.5 and those ones do not. Which one are we supposed to pay attention to?
Well, it's a balancing process, I guess, that you both have to go through, and that's kind of the issue of looking at this. There's an acceptance, I think, that 66, you'll find King Sandy, that is, you need to protect those significant vegetation communities. That there is quite a broad objective, I think, the one up there that you were referring to. I don't see that they actually, I think they can sit side by side, but when you get down into those specific objectives and policies and the actual check the dealings with the indigenous provider. This is where I think you have a bit of a problem.
Just looking at your opening of that paragraph, and you say the protectionist approach is at odds with the strategic directions as it relates to rural land use. Are you suggesting that the policies that Commissioner Sinclair referred to under Objective 3243 are not related to rural land use?
I'm talking about the enabling policies for agriculture, if you look at the Dow Fort, that is a bit of a tension as well as is between that and that type of policy.
Isn't there a potential for both to work together?
There is, and that's kind of the crux of my evidence really, is that it's not quite there, it's not far off. That's not quite there when you get into that lower sort of broader ecological function that a council has to maintain. What I'm saying is that, well, that doesn't mean you have to check every piece of vegetation.
Paragraph 22, the last sentence there about laypersons not knowing about the what plants might exist within environments, and only one single threatened plant could trigger consent. Do you have any idea about what it costs to get an ecologist in place to come and assess things like that?
Well, I'm sat in a very similar position to you quite recently on the same sort of issue, and I've heard varying reports on that, but I have been advised that around $5,000 to assess a farm.
How big a farm?
I actually pulled the car after that, but there is a range of costs. People that are following me probably have a better idea on that, but I have been $5,000 to $10,000 on that. But then I have been advised by a couple of others, but I really can't give you an answer on that. I guess all the reason, the point I was making in that paragraph was sort of very difficult, particularly in a dryland environment, for the labourers and that you can work out whether they are compliant with those thresholds or not. A lot of councils have doubt that it's reasonably obvious here indigenous vegetation is just because of the nature of it, and it's quite different than this sort of district.
Okay. So in paragraph 30 on page 10, can you give us some examples where you refer to the obscure and cryptic species on the list?
Probably actually all back to me, sir. You talked about fruit plants, and that probably illustrates the point. I don't really know what any of those plants would be, so. That answers the question, but to me they're all quite obscure. I'm not saying they're not important, it's just I don't actually know what they are.
Okay, thank you. On page 10 again, just in paragraph 32, referring to the functions of the regional council. Is there any clarification in the proposed regional policy statement regarding which councils are responsible for which parts of biodiversity?
Yeah, the proposed.
Yeah.
I haven't, to be honest, actually haven't considered that in any great detail. I was more looking at the policy framework in terms of what they are seeking to achieve, but generally it sits with the territorial authorities.
Thank you.
Have you been involved in consenting for any farming activities on the Cripple Station?
No.
You haven't. We heard from Mandy Bell last week that there was about 300 hectares on the Cripple that was currently under irrigation, and the potential for another 100 odd hectares. You've highlighted the increase in productivity from modernised irrigation methods. Would you consider it to be onerous for Cripple to need to apply the consent for additional irrigation over the station?
That's probably the crux of the end, is we all certainly need to go to the consent processes because the uncertainty around what the outcome may be in some of the policies. They're quite, for example, the policy 33.2.2.1, which avoids the clearance of indigenous vegetation from the ECAs, but then that brings you back into that the policy before that also is 33.2.1.10. When we look at that criteria, that's the issue here, I think. It throws you back into that when we apply the threatened land specification environments. Automatically, you're within that area, and they're probably going to say that it's significant. So that's the issue, I think, that they face, that they're uncertain about whether they can actually, if they have to, increase their area of irrigation to make it economic. They're not entirely sure that they get through that business. But it is a cost of the process, we all know that. There are ways around managing that, and a lot of people are starting to look at biodiversity management plans where you apply that to your whole farm, so there's options of doing that. But I think it's the ongoing process here. Every time you go for a consent, you have to do it on case by case basis. That can become quite a costly process. I think what I've said by it is far critical when people accept and agree with the protection of SNRs. You should also look at the other issues around that and the threatened natural treated plants and any other indigenous vegetation. It's important that general function be identified straight up, which should be the council's job in my view. Doesn't always work in some districts, understand that. And then those both have that certainty, so they go, well, we can go to 85% biodiversity for hectares, and we have the maintained value of there as a particularly SNA. I just think that's a critical approach to, and you'll get that. What I'm saying, Liam, is it's very difficult for a one-off case-by-case assessment actually work out how you maintain the indigenous vegetation as required if you don't know the full extent of it over a district and you haven't done that assessment. So that's another thing to factor into that consent process. There's a lot of uncertainty around that.
Just on your answer, do you have any experience in dealing with consents for dry land areas, either in this district or Central Otago or Mackenzie, the three districts that have maybe even Waitaki?
Irrigation consents?
Well, any change of farming use that would impact on dry land indigenous vegetation?
No, not in those changing use scenarios. No. most of my irrigation has been in places called South and stuff like that, where they don't have this particular fishing. But I understand that the whole irrigation sort of issues that face. That next largest reason for a lot of the commentary around the RPS and the regional policy statements, policy in there, it's not necessarily that important for this thing, but what the councils are doing more and more regularly is that it's the efficient use of resources, so you end up with a bit of conflict with what regional council requires people to do, and that, and it's quite direct in their policies, and that conflict with what a district council seeks to achieve for other examples of that in Canterbury, where, for example, faces of what a farmer would call a scrub is indigenous surprise Wesley, but it's quite weedy. They've been issued with non-compliance notices from Canterbury Regional Council to go and clear the weeds, spray the weeds. They've done that, and then they've got a slack on the end on the other side of things because it's important, supposedly important biodiversity. So that's what I would like to see in a document like this, avoid those conflicts between the objectives of two different local authorities that deal with these issues. And you do have that potential.
Mr.
Chairman.
We heard from Dr. Esty last week that it could be a situation where you might apply for consent for irrigation, and it may result in the reduction of the amount of indigenous vegetation in an area, but as long as a representative example was protected as part of that consent, then he didn't see any reason why consent couldn't be processed or proceeded with. Are you saying you don't think there should be a need to apply for consent in the first place, or you don't see a way through this consenting pathway?
No, I think the consent pathway, the way it's currently written, could be potentially difficult. Just because of those issues that are raised, didn't have the benefit of hearing what Dr. Easton said, but you can get through those consent processes. The irrigation consent is the same issue, so you have any regard to the impact on biodiversity, so they run side by side, so there is some fun. Well, I'm assuming you try and run it side by side with the district council. I guess the point I'm making is it's production land, and the reason there's very little vegetation, indigenous vegetation in that area is because that's where we farm. So if it's production land, I think you need a less restrictive sort of consent process, probably in my view. But having said that, I think the best way to do it is actually to have a district-wide study and look at all this stuff in one hit, so you know what's there. You know what's protected, you know what you need to protect.
So it's a sort of a balancing of public and private interests.
Yeah, because the benefit largely rests with the wider community. Most farmers actually benefit on their property, they like it on their property as well, and probably assist in their land value. Most farms I know now see it as an asset. There are small groups around that don't. They don't like being told what to do, but it's the nature of the game. So I just think it's more efficient, more effective, you'll get a better outcome than you would on a case-by-case scenario. And I realise in some districts you can't do that, just because of the nature of what's happened before. But I think in this particular district, I think rural land users are actually well aware of the environment they live in. From my understanding, they're actually quite receptive to that sort of approach. I haven't heard any concerns around that. You know, in terms of allowing colleges to come on as a part of that wider sort of study, that may have been. So I may be wrong on that, but I've just never seen that issue here that you do have in some other districts.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Wilson,
please. Yeah.
Just on your paragraph 24, you're talking about this issue of whether council can control the application of water.
Yeah.
You're familiar with the definition of use in section 2 of the Act, I presume.
It's been a long time since I read that. Yeah, it's applying to include a fine a substance or a material to length.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, this perhaps if I read out the other parts just to remind you. It's in subsection A, little 3, damage, destroy or disturb the habitats of plants or animals in on or under land. And then in little 4, deposit a substance in on or under land. If there was conducting a land use activity, farmer irrigates his land, isn't that part of the land use?
I would say in a general sense, yes.
Mm. And isn't that different from the actual discharge or take of the water involved?
Well, I think that the component of that land use is the discharge.
But that's different from the act of irrigation, isn't it?
Well, the act of irrigation is actually machines spraying the water on the...
Mm.
Yeah, which is a discharge.
Well, the discharge is permitted under the regional plan too, isn't it?
Yeah.
If... Isn't the situation similar or exactly the same as the emission of odour, where a land use may create odour and be controlled by the council because of that, but the actual emission, that is the source of the odour, is controlled by the regional council?
Yes, and the other one controlling effects, there's probably two others you can control that would be dust.
Mm.
And sediment discharge. Now, and councils, some councils don't like dealing with those because they see all more from the end of the regional council, but I do take your point.
That's quite normal on some person consents to put in sediment control plans, etc.
You're making a case for a unitary deduction.
Mm.
But I do accept your point, and you'll note that what I've said in there, that I haven't gone that far, I'm just questioning whether that is an appropriate function of the district council, given the specific function of the district council. But if you consider in the wider, as I said before, and it was the same with the regional Canberra example of spraying the wheat, they don't consider the biodiversity aspect, it's just one function. Some irrigation may be done, consider the effect it may have on the patches with the new rock growth. So I do understand that point.
So in the last sentence in that paragraph, you talk about how it might somehow affect consents for water takes. Could you explain how that relationship that you're getting at the entrance?
Well, I guess that's in the common, the first part of it is about, how are you going to actually determine what effects you're having? District Council probably aren't the right people to understand that particular process.
But the District Council is not proposing to get involved in the water takes.
Once the discharge to the actual activity base, so it's going to be a clearance issue. My concern there would be straightforward
renewal of a water tank, which I think they're going through in this particular area, that the change in application rates, all those things, are likely to have a different impact on the cost that they're currently putting water on, to discharge or land use activity. So that's going to change, potentially change the nature of how those plants react to that, or that's actually the best of it, I guess. So there's potentially a difficulty there, and they may, the district council gets involved in that because you're renewing your irrigation permits and you have to do it a certain way, and it may end up being more efficient to get more grass growth to carry out some of those dry things. That could be an issue for plants.
Isn't a concern of the regional council on water takes to ensure that the water is used efficiently?
Yes.
If, due to the presence of indigenous vegetation, an area that was to be irrigated had to be set aside for irrigation, and this is purely hypothetical.
Had to be set aside for not being irrigated?
From not being irrigated, yes. Surely that improves the efficiency rather than reduces the efficiency. Or at minimum doesn't change it in terms of the actual land irrigated.
Well, it seems to happen that the new systems that are required, with the spray irrigators, so the amount of money that has to go into those investments, I think it was very good or purple having to go another 100 hectares that they need to irrigate. My understanding from that extent is they probably actually need to do that to actually pay for the irrigation system. So they're actually probably looking to irrigate more to actually achieve the outcome sought by the regional council.
I'm just wondering, given your lack of experience in these issues of dryland, indigenous vegetation, can sense whether, on what basis you're making that statement, because there's no way of knowing whether it's half a hectare that needs to be protected out of the 100, or as Dr. Espy said, some of the, there are particularly threatened plants, they can perhaps be transplanted, or the nature of the irrigation is designed to avoid the particular areas. I'm just wondering on what basis you made that.
So yes, it's sort of basis of having experience in the dry land environment. I know that that cost me money to go to those new systems. You would have seen them. It's, your old water life brush is a pretty cheap way of doing it. A lot of money tied up in irrigation settings. What I've seen in other parts of the country when you tend to do that, generally they put more water in under the command area, they put more land under the command area simply because they're happy to get the return on their own investments.
That's finance related. Under water permits, though, under the Act, the water permit includes take, but it also includes use of memory. Is the function different, though, between the regional council addressing the water take and its use, whereas the function here is the district council, and it's my understanding it's directed by the RPS, proposed RPS, that the district council is the one that have to look after biodiversity?
Yes.
And such, and therefore that's where the district council is getting its mandate through the Act from that, in terms of being able to address this matter. So they're actually separate. But given what you just said, would there be examples where if you're going to do irrigation, that if you're putting in an application for it, that at the same time there's other consents that you might require, and therefore it's come under Section 91 of the RMA?
So I think I had a question from Commissioner James that this is how it's going to operate. It's exactly what you're doing. required to consider to both councils or whatever. So there is some efficiency in that regard. It doesn't help the initial design of your irrigation scheme, but we have to do all that work for you.
Thank you.
Just one final question. On paragraph 29, you I'm just wondering if we are to take from this paragraph that you consider that farming should be exempt from any controls on clearing vegetation, ignoring SMAs.
No, what I'm saying is that you have improved pasture, whatever indigenous vegetation had within that is probably not a grazing spot anyway. Generally, you've got grazing spot in there, trampling, chewing on, that sort of stuff. Well, there's a definite production land in the act. That is probably going a little bit too far because there's quite extensive grazing of lots of land that you're containing this vegetation. But you've got improved pasture, I think. I don't understand why you want to actually be involved in those sorts of issues, and given the enabling framework that the district plan promotion. So it's where you've got to look at drawing the line.
So what you're saying is that it's improved pasture, then they should not apply.
There's no reason for you to go into that area as farming.
Thank you. Department of Conservation. I have a question for you that has arisen in relation to another submission. The department has lodged a further submission in opposition to a submission by NZ Ski. And we have an email that is copied to us saying the department was going to withdraw that. I'm just wondering if you can confirm that the department is formally withdrawing it, or has formally withdrawn that further submission?
I can answer. There was a memo that was also signed. I don't know if that's been provided to you.
Yes.
That was by the chief solicitor, I believe. You're talking about an email, right?
Yes. Yes, there was an email, and all I agree on is that I had it from NZ Ski that you were withdrawing. I wanted to be sure. From the department that you were offering that to the submission.
It hasn't been provided to you, but there was a short memo that was signed by both parties that should have been.
That may be what we're missing then.
Provided, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So, yeah,
I think we're hearing from them tomorrow. No, on Wednesday. So I'll check with them then.
Would you like me to read through my submission to you?
Yes, probably help. Sort of.
I will approve too.
I'll start with the functions of the Director General and the Department. The Director General is the administrative chief of the Department of Conservation, so it's the person who makes the submission. The functions of the Department are set out in Section 6C of the Conservation Act, and the relevant functions in that section include management for conservation services, all land and all other natural and historic resources for the time being held under that Act, and all land and other natural resources and historic resources whose owner agrees with the Minister they should be managed by the Department, and to advocate for the conservation of natural and historic resources generally, and every other function conferred on it by another enactment. In relation to those functions, the Director General's powers include those reasonably necessary or expedient to enable the Department to perform its functions. The submissions on the district plan are focused on Chapter 33 of the proposed plan. The decisions sought are primarily intended to address the Section 6C Resource Management Act requirements, which is as a matter of national importance, recognise and provide for the protection of areas of significant Indigenous vegetation and significant habitat for Indigenous fauna. And I'm referring to those as SMAs, they're referred as that in the plan as well. In the case of the Royal Forestenberg Protection Society and the Plymouth District Council, the Environment Court stated that the Section 6C requirement is both directive and obligatory, and it applies to areas and habitats of both regional and district significance. Mr. Duvall and Mr. Rance have observed that the Council has identified many SMAs which are supposed to be listed in the schedule to the plan and which will then be subject to the provision regarding the way they should be treated, and our submission is that that's a significant improvement on the operative district plan. However, there are additional sites, such as two examples that are described most by Mr. Rance and his evidence, which are not included in the scheduled list, despite meeting the criteria for identification as an SNA. Those two sites are just examples, and there may be other sites as well. Furthermore, other submitters have sought to remove some sites from the scheduled list or alter their boundaries, despite those sites meeting the criteria for classification as SNA. The Director General's submission seeks to ensure that SNAs are recognised and that adequate provision is made in the plan for their protection, even if they have not or have not yet been identified in the schedule to the plan. That can be achieved by including provisions, which are discussed by Mr. Duvall, for identifying them in the course of assessing new development proposals. The Department's concern is to ensure that as yet unidentified SNAs are not lost, and in my submission, the requirement to make provision for the protection of them applies whether or not they have been formally identified at the time of the promulgation of the plan. There's no exemption under Section 6C for SNAs that have not yet been identified. Therefore, as the plan's list is incomplete, Section 6C obligation of my position needs to be discharged by including a regime that will provide for the ongoing recognition of them and their protection, their provision for their protection. The meaning of the word protection was considered in the case I referred to earlier, the New Plymouth case, where the court said it means to keep safe from harm, injury or damage. And the court added that it was implicit in the concept of protection that adequate protection is required. As Mr. Duvall states in his evidence, the proposed new provision in Chapter 33 provides some assurance that previously unidentified SNAs will be identified and consequently protected in the course of assessing proposals for new activities, because the presence of threatened species will trigger a requirement for restricted discretionary consent.
That's right.
Actually, yeah. A in the absence of that triggering provision, an alternative mechanism would be required to provide for the protection that SNA is looking at being identified. Stock submission regarding the definition of clearance of vegetation, clearance of vegetation seeks to ensure that all of the means by which vegetation may be cleared are captured. The proposed definition already acknowledges that vegetation may be cleared by applying water, and it's relevant to your discussion with the previous submitter. And DOC has submitted in support of that definition. However, the proposed definition does not include overflowing, and Mr. Rand discusses that overflowing and irrigation are both methods of clearing indigenous vegetation. On the question of clearing indigenous vegetation by irrigation, it's worth noting that the Royal Forest and Bird Protection Society and Waitangi District Council case included a note from that acknowledgement from the court that Federated Farmers' own submission was that a variety of farming techniques could achieve significant vegetation change, and the techniques listed in that decision included irrigation as well as grazing and nutrients and other farming techniques. In my submission, the proposed definition of vegetation clearance applies to all methods of clearance because the list of methods in the definition is not exhaustive, that starts with include. However, understanding of the plan by its users is likely to be improved by expressly including reference to clearance methods such as irrigation and oversight. And that will enable the provisions relevant to protection of indigenous biodiversity to be implemented more effectively. Another area that the department has submitted on in this plan and is submitting on in other plans as they come up for review is biodiversity offsetting. The department seeks to ensure that the plan's provisions are consistent with current national and international understanding and implementation of biodiversity offsetting. And Dr. Barea's evidence includes the discussion of the relevant principles. The Environment Court in the Manawatū 2 Regional Council's one plan hearing concluded that the principles are a sound basis for policy. The court in that case also observed that the national proposed national policy statement on indigenous biodiversity reflects the principles and considered that notwithstanding it has no statutory effect, the document is worthy of respect as a reflection of considered opinion, particularly as it reflects international best practice. So in conclusion, the Director General seeks the relief sought out in the submission and as further set out in the evidence in the 12. It's my submission that the amendment sought will address the Council's Section 6C obligation and its Section 31(1)(c)(3) function to control any actual potential effects of the youth development and protection of land or the maintenance of indigenous biological diversity.
Thank you. Just to clarify, in paragraph 8, and I've noted this in Mr. Marks's evidence, he's described two areas that could be considered as SNAs, but we'll include them in the list. Just clarifying that the department has presented that as examples rather than seeking them to be included in the list, is that correct?
Yes, they're just to demonstrate that the list is not complete. As Mr. Rant said, there's been significant progress made, but there is still further work to be done before the department will be satisfied that the list of SNAs in the plan is a complete list.
The Waitaki District FAB case you referred to, Have you provided a copy of this thing for us?
I have brought one copy with me. Sorry, I didn't bring a lot of copies because of difficulties with getting much material on the plane, but I can read a copy with you.
That was the Forest and Birds and Plymouth District one, was that before or after King Salmon?
It was very recent, it was after.
Yeah, I noticed that all of the witnesses are employees of the Department of Conservation.
They are?
Yep. Should I ask you or them whether they've got authority to present evidence on behalf of the department or not, since it's not addressed in their evidence?
You can address that to them, but they do have authority to present evidence on behalf of
the department. If they could just confirm that?
Yes.
That would be good, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, in that case, I will ask Mr. Barnes to prepare a brief summary, a one-page summary of the hearing, which I can start reading that.
Thank you. I appreciate the question. I'll start by confirming that I didn't have a few authority. So my evidence covers a personal apology report and full evidence, and so I have a one-page summary structure. So there is a huge amount of ecological biodiversity and biological diversity found in the Queenstown Lakes District. This ecological biological diversity is not only characteristic of the area, it is unique and of national importance. The richness of biodiversity includes flora, fauna, ecosystems, and is a reflection of the ecological diversity that includes climate, soils, and landforms of the Queenstown Lakes District. The presence and conservation of ecological sequences is an important consideration. Ecological sequences may reflect gradients in altitude, climate, soils, moisture, regeneration, and other ecological factors. In my opinion, the proposed district plan includes criteria and processes for selecting significant natural areas that are appropriate. Further, ecological significance should be assessed by reference to both accepted ecological assessment criteria and the national biodiversity priorities. It is appropriate that these ecological assessment criteria are applied to all sites of Indigenous vegetation that are proposed for modification or development. Ecological assessment should be undertaken by a skilled ecologist or other appropriate practitioner. Some threatened plants and other threatened species, notably invertebrates and lizards, and some other values may not be readily apparent to many landowners, land governments or developers or lay people. If the proposed plan relies on significant natural areas as a mechanism to recognise and protect the extent of significance of the biodiversity remaining in Queenstown Lakes District, a large number of SNOs needs to be included in the plan. In my opinion, the identification of 147 significant areas can be considered as a starting point. It is likely that as additional information becomes available, including through development proposals, that further areas that meet the criteria to be SNOs will be identified. In my evidence, I identified two examples that I believe meet the criteria to be considered as significant natural areas. These two examples are sites that I've worked on in recent years, and I've undertaken comprehensive assessment of these sites and believe that they are likely to meet the SNA criteria. However, I believe that there would be several, if not many, others in other parts of the district that would also meet those criteria. I note that a number of submissions seek alterations or removal of SNAs from the schedule in Chapter 33. In my opinion, if SNAs are to be reconsidered and to ensure that they are identified consistently, they should be identified in accordance with the accepted methods of assessing ecological values rather than by considering the potential for development of the site. Ecological assessments need to be undertaken at the appropriate scale, and that may be at each of local, regional, and national scales. The local scale should be in the context of the relevant ecological disciplines. In my opinion, it is appropriate to include a comprehensive schedule of threatened and at risk plants from the Queensland Lakes District, as the inclusion of that information will enable informed decisions to be made under the plan. Further, the schedules of threatened plant species and other threatened species within the Stiglitz Davis reserves are extensive and appropriate. Ideally, the threatened species schedules should be updated in accordance with the national reviews of the New Zealand Threat Classification System, and that's approximately every 5 years. This would ensure that any additional species recorded in the future would also be covered by the system criteria. In order to manage the effects of threatened indigenous communities or ecosystems, communities, habitats, flora and fauna, the full range of activities that may affect them need to be identified. The activities that will result in the loss or modification are much wider than the direct mechanical, chemical and burning to clear vegetation. These other activities that can adversely affect indigenous ecosystems and habitats include direct drilling, oversowing of pasture species, irrigation and others. There's poultry and other as well. And finally, number 12, the wilding trees, particularly conifers, present a major threat to upland and alpine vegetation through much of New Zealand, including the Queenstown Lakes District. The list of wilding tree species listed in the control proposed on the planting of wilding conifers and other wilding tree species are likely to be affected in managing the threat of it. That's brief. Thank you.
Just around this, we've had a number of landowners made submissions that said to us that because their land had been through tenure review, all the areas of any significance had been identified and separated out. In your experience, is that the case with land that's gone through tenure review?
Well, short answer is no. The Pastoral Lands Act has distinct purposes which are in some way separate from the Resource Management Act, and the process is a compromised, negotiated outcome, so not necessarily are all the significant areas identified and protected.
Just related to that, when Maine goes through this tenure review, does the same sort of identification as set out in the policy here regarding representative for rarity diversity, is that kind of thing done by someone such as yourself during those processes?
The department has a criteria of what's called adherent values or significant adherent values that are reviewed. But essentially the same sort of criteria are included within those.
Is that word public?
I'm not sure it's formally published, but it would be, I think, publicly available.
I'm just wondering
if the other party knows of the criteria, and the last review date of those is 2011-2012.
No, it wasn't the criteria I was asking. If on tenure review the department undertakes a survey, and presumably the survey is undertaken before the negotiations, is that survey information public and readily available?
To my knowledge, all those surveys go onto the Lynn's website, so it's accessible through that plan site or past releases. There is probably a time, I'm not sure how long it takes before it gets on that website, but it does go onto that website.
Is that a publicly available website, or is it a website that you have to...
Anyone can
access it. Anyone can.
Just the other matter I wanted to ask you is if you had had a chance to read Dr. Espy's evidence.
No, I haven't.
Okay. The other question, which is a general question which has been raised, is the use of the LEMS threatened environment classification system for determining the point at which various consents might be required or not. Do you have any views on whether that is a robust method that could be relied on?
I think it's sound that it is in some ways a surrogate for biodiversity in terms of it uses 13 or more physical parameters, but those will determine the environments and, I suppose, if I call it growing conditions for the species that are there. So it reflects those environments and so it does give an indication of the degree of loss, though. It shows where the greatest loss has been, areas of, I suppose, greatest concern. But it gets updated periodically, so that there will be loss going on in between. So in some of those areas, perhaps classified as at risk, may change status if there is development that's gone on, and sometimes development of areas can be pulsed as a particular land use has some precedence, I suppose. And I think it's also, as I say, it's a very useful tool, but as a tool, it's probably not 100% effective, but I think it is a very sound and very useful tool.
We've had people tell us that the scale that it's at isn't exactly helpful in terms of identifying vegetation. Is that your view on?
I think in some cases that, in terms of you look at land forms, that I know of some examples where on the lake, say the land form, there seems to be a boundary, which I would question in some of that. So whether that is a scale or some other, one of the characters might have picked up that. But generally, the topography and data available is quite accurate. But there may be some examples, some valid examples, where there could be mapping issues to be looked at. But I found it to be a very useful and accurate tool.
Paragraph 23 this is the areas to be determined through development proposals. Do you have an idea how you might, from your perspective, how you might see that appearing in the plan? So with the determination of SNAs, for instance, that aren't identified in the plan?
As I say, I think as information becomes available, I'd like to see a mechanism that additional areas are added. So I think the 147 that are there is a vast improvement from the previous plan, and it's a very good start, but I don't believe that it will be a full assessment of everything of significance in the district. And I suppose there is an issue there that it leaves a degree of uncertainty if there is potential for areas to be added in the future. But because I don't believe at this stage that there is a full assessment of everything of significance in the district, at this time, that that there isn't that information.
In paragraph 28, at the end of that paragraph, when you talk about methods of should be done in accordance with methods assessing ecological values rather than considering the potential for development. Could you clarify, just trying to, what do you mean by that?
Well, in the plan that there are a list of criteria that were used for assessing significance, and I believe the significance should be on those accepted and used criteria rather than other motivations in terms of economics and potential for use. That's a follow on from after the identification of significance.
And I take it that my understanding is that that method was used in terms of the identification of the existing SNAs and that
from a
specialist perspective,
yes,
that's the appropriate way to go about it.
Yes, and in my example, use those same criteria to say that I believe that those two examples also fit that criteria.
That being the case, sorry, is there any reason why the department, the director general, didn't then seek to have those included within the plan if they're that important that they should be identified?
I have not done a comprehensive assessment of significance throughout. I've only used a couple of examples, so they could be added, but it doesn't actually fix the problem, I don't believe, only in a small way.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hunt. So back to paragraph 24 in your statement of evidence, the two examples that you give, the Trident Terrace and the Lindsay Tarn, you mentioned in the summary that you believe there could be several, if not many, others in the district. Based on your experience in the district, would you be hazard a guess as to what overall proportion of SNA sites you think have been identified, or what's left over to be done?
try to avoid that really, in terms of I haven't done that assessment, and there is also, I suppose, a lot of the areas that are protected public crown land would probably meet those criteria, and they are not included. So there's a large subset there probably, but as I said, that these are two properties that I have been involved with, and both of those had examples that, you know, so that's probably three or four properties that I've had involvement with, and I believe in detail, should I say, and I believe all those would have significant areas on them, and the majority of those have not been identified.
So if you're suggesting that it's an overall district-wide assessment that's required of SNAs as opposed to ad hoc development-oriented sort of proposals, of course the issue that we have is you need the time and the money to go looking in order to be able to find something, and that's generally around when someone wants to effect some sort of change. So how would you imagine a more complete SNA assessment would be undertaken? Is it just more of the same, and when do you stop?
My concern is that there are some things that are annual or may periodically be present that are easy to miss. I see it as a very difficult thing to ever be comprehensive. Also, our assessment tools are changing, threatened species listings change, so with all those things, it is a bit of a movable feast to face. The challenge for the council more difficult, but by having appropriate criteria, the site by site will bring that up. That will allow for assessment in the detail, probably targeting areas that are being looked at for some proposal.
Okay. So if we were to imagine that a more comprehensive SNA assessment is undertaken for the district, and capture at least all of those sites that you're aware of, and maybe a few more, would that make the protection of indigenous vegetation through, say, those the definition
using irrigation and the other methods, would they become less important? So if we had a more comprehensive suite of SNAs?
I think that the closer you get to, if I call it the future, to a good coverage, then those other criteria will become less important probably.
So a really robust set of SNA assessments that identifies pretty close to the full square size could be the main mechanism that's used in the bank for protection of biodiversity?
Yes, well, as I said before, I'd always caution that there's always something that could fall through the cracks if you put it that way. So there's always a risk that some values of significance will be missed. And it's only at that detailed on site that you can have a high degree of confidence in that.
I guess following on from Commissioner Cummings, you're saying that the list of species was updated every 5 years. I'm trying to figure out if the district were to undertake an analysis of the SNAs across the district, then how often would that need to be undertaken in terms of, is that likely to change considerably? Would that have to be done every 10 years with every district plan?
For threatened species, I know, for example, this year threatened plant, vascular plants are being reviewed, so it's a rolling front between different groups, so roughly 5 years, but because there has been a number of reviews, the amount of change in on each review is probably reducing as our information continues to improve. But conversely, in terms of some areas perhaps that have been modified by, say, fire in the past, will be regenerating, and as time goes on, their closeness to a more original, if I use that term, system will increase, so their significance will increase. So nature is never static, and that it is changing constantly. So I see two paths. One is if there is a schedule that's there, but if it can be linked to the most recent threat listing, it allows that, in terms of the threatened species, that information to come into account. In terms of other change that may occur at the time, a lot of that will be reasonably slow, so maybe a 10 yearly or something like that period of reassessment, which in many cases, if there are SNAs, would be a process of reconfirmation rather than necessarily resurvey. A lot of the values would be apparent that there hasn't been a change, so that the value should still be there.
And when you use the term development, I'm just thinking for this district, I guess, growth of rural residential, rural lifestyle areas as well. From that term development, you would suggest that before any of that upzoning were carried out, that area should also be assessed if it hasn't been already?
Yes, there may be some truth. One would be, is there indigenous vegetation or habitat present? Another trigger that may help us in this may be the lens, that is a flag of, whether we use as a tool, or a flag of degree of loss, and so rarity and importance.
Lizzie will refer to this Waitaki case, which my understanding, without having seen it, refers to actual grazing as an issue for as a method of removed vegetation clearance.
Yeah,
It's not one that you identified. You talked about directional, drilling, direct drilling and oversowing and those kind of things. Is it an issue for a
minute? It certainly is a method of modification of vegetation. I suppose it is a sensitive one, and generally grazing is seen as an accepted activity, but the flag may be in terms of where there's a change in land use, in terms of an increased density or stocking rates or change in stock type, from sheep to deer or to cattle, or tied with other things which may be picked up, oversowing, top dressing, irrigation, will usually come with a change in land use or intensity of land use.
Good morning, and first of all, I'd also like to confirm that I have authority to present evidence on behalf of the department. So I have a brief summary here. I take it my evidence has been read. Would you like me to read the summary or go straight to the question?
Yes, do you have any other copies of that
summary? We can arrange this.
Right.
It's taken directly out of my evidence.
Right.
So I'm recommending that the proposed plan include a new policy for biodiversity offsets, a definition of biodiversity offset, and if it chooses to retain provisions for environmental compensation, then a definition for that. In accordance with the guidance, good practice guidance, document on biodiversity offsetting, I provided wording for these within my efforts. Between 2009 and 2014, the department led a cross-government department research program to investigate and develop guidance on biodiversity offsetting in New Zealand. The guidance draws from broadly accepted international guidance and was launched by the Minister of Conservation on August 2014. Biodiversity offsetting refers to a process that seeks to counterbalance the unavoidable effects of activities on biodiversity by enhancing the state of biodiversity at a site other than the affected site. The guidance draws from international guidance when it defines biodiversity offsets as measurable conservation outcomes resulting from actions designed to compensate for significant residual adverse biodiversity impacts arising from project development after appropriate prevention and mitigation measures have been taken. The goal of biodiversity offsets is to achieve no net loss and preferably prevent gain of biodiversity on the ground. And it's that definition that I'm recommending the plan adopt for biodiversity offsets. I support the intent of the plan to provide for biodiversity offsets, but I'm of the view that as worded, it does not provide the strength, clarity, and detail required. Accordingly, I propose the alternative text that I present in my evidence as a replacement for proposed policy 33.2.1.8. I have that proposed text within the summary taken directly from my evidence.
We can take that as read. It's on page 13.
So with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. The Business Biodiversity Offset Program, does that tend to be a project specific, or are you aware of examples where the approach has been laid out at a district or regional level throughout New Zealand?
the guidance that's been produced will basically more than you can do both. At a practical level, it's on a case-by-case basis because you're balancing losses of a particular development activity with gains. So by very nature, that's context-specific, case-specific, and offset is addressed at that level. A region could, if it wanted to, use biodiversity offsets as part of a suite of tools aimed at maintaining biodiversity at a regional level. That is something that is you call that a strategic use of biodiversity offsets, and could be developed at a regional level or district level by councils. The guidance that has been produced from New Zealand at the moment is directed at guiding the development and assessment of biodiversity offsets on a case by case basis. That question might be directed to Mr. Bell in terms of the planning context for the overall plan and the implications for that. What I'm recommending is that currently the plan provides for biodiversity offsets, but basically provides no detail around it. We have that detail and guidance developed at a national level, but I'm recommending that a policy be further developed to provide that detail and with reference to that guidance as a helpful source of information for both practitioners, developers and assessors. How that affects other parts of the plan that I may not have read, I think that's a kind of
I'll put that question to Mr. Tidol, but in terms of other examples being used, saying sort of principle used, what other types of measures do you think might be required within the plan? Is there a sort of a flow down of policies and rules required around this, or is it looking for a definition and a policy and then leave it there?
The proposed policy that I have recommended contains measures around what's known as the mitigation hierarchy. In the absence of that within the biodiversity offset policy, I would have said that should be addressed as possible in the plan. I've explained in my evidence why the mitigation hierarchy is important for biodiversity offsets. I don't know if you want to go into that further, but it's essentially to ensure that the offset is the last step in impact management processes, and that the size and nature of the offset and its achievability is the size is as small as possible and the achievability is as high.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. We've had a couple of questions from Mike before about the National Policy Statement of Biodiversity, which is bulk. Is offsetting included in that?
Yes, and that's drawn very strongly from the Business and Biodiversity Offsets Program, the international one, which the the New Zealand guidance towards very heavy fog. Basically, you can find a bit of that work in New Zealand context. The NDS was put out before BMOP published their international offset guidance, so it doesn't contain some of the principles that the latter publication did. Essentially, it's very similar.
Right, it is in terms of scalability, maybe that's a question for Hannah, but the flow down from a national policy statement through regional, district, local, could, I guess, help to give that broader perspective?
I think it's advantageous if we had that policy statement with by the offset angles officer. As you'll be aware, the Minister has announced
so adopting the EBOP would fit nicely into that in terms of
given what's already in the proposed.
And just the assumption being that once these areas of offset are created, I guess it sort of requires them to come back to criteria as to whether then they would also become SNA. So this would be the ability to add additional SNA to these areas of offset.
I think the offset has worked. That applies to any kind of mitigation or compensation. There's always uncertainty. I would think yes, they should develop those values, and over time they've become more valuable and what the nature of the offset is should trigger significant pressure.
And put more interest in anything else. In terms of the ecological counting required to actually offset, there's a hierarchy of values that are given to rarity with the different criteria, I guess. So looking at a very simple schematic on divided diversity value of two areas. You believe that the data to back up those sort of counting is thorough and complete?
Yeah, that's something that comes up all the time with offsetting. There's some views that are not too favourable towards offsetting that say, oh, it requires too much data to perform the balancing part of the offset. But that wasn't helped with what happened with the demonstrated proposed offset there, which became very complicated. But it doesn't need to be like that. It makes sense that the level of data required for an offset should be commensurate with the complexity of the biodiversity we try. We've got a very complex biodiversity of extremely high values. And that's under consideration for loss, then I don't see why it's unreasonable to take good account of what actually is being lost and what is being proposed as a gain to count that loss. If the biodiversity is quite simple and uniform and easily dealt, then I don't see that a really complicated process. Bit more straightforward.
Could we look at an offset example? What would be the best one in the country that's currently happening? Do they have successfully offset?
Offsets take a lot of time from the establishment to actually achieve goals. The offsets guidance has also only been out since August 2014. So there are no offsets that are consistent with that guidance that have actually had time to achieve or actually to be implemented. But if you look at the consent conditions for the Waitoa Water Storage Project, then there is a biodiversity offset that is consistent with the guidance that's required in those consent conditions. If you went back, if you looked at the, there are elements of offsetting that would be consistent with the guidance, but not in the priority transmission going and the Malkas wind farm. The Haruru Mararaki wind farm has a quite comprehensive offset design within it, but that's, so I understand that that wind farm is going to go ahead, so that offset will not be. But we are at an early stage in biodiversity offsetting within New Zealand and globally, and just that question in a few years of time, I could answer it. That's very interesting.
Thank you.
We're going to adjourn until 5:20 before Bishop Sinclair, because otherwise we'll be here until 5:11. So 5:12. Sorry, yes. We'll adjourn until 11:55.